Kia ora and welcome to Beyond Consultation, a podcast that will help you in your public or community sector work to increase your impact by doing more than just ticking the box of consultation. I'm Paul McGregor from Business Lab, and we're interested in the mindsets and methods of people who are making a bigger impact by working collaboratively with communities, industries, and other organizations. Ngā mihi mō te whakaroa. Today I'd like to start the episode with 5 or 6 seconds of silence for you to think of the last gathering you attended where there was a shocking or tense moment. I don't know about you, but these moments seem to happen quite a lot in my work. A board meeting where somebody burst into tears. A training workshop where a white man objected to the use of te reo Māori. A public meeting where there were a couple of residents yelling at public officials. These situations are all around us. And often what happens is we go into our lizard primeval brain, the flight, fight, freeze, befriend mode. And as a group, we try to speed past the moment as fast as possible. We just try to crush this tense, shocking moment back into the tin, but we can't get the lid on and it's kind of still there in the room and we just get out as fast as we can. Generally, that's what happens. Well, today's show is all about those everyday shocking moments where what's happening is a past unresolved trauma is showing up in the present. What comes up for you when you hear that word trauma? Do you want to run in the opposite direction or are you happy to lean in with a bit of curiosity? I say let's get stuck in because today's guest is here to guide us in how to work with trauma effectively. Louise Mara has both Ngā Tūhoe and Pākehā heritage, and she brings both of those into her work, where she's helping people to change how systems work by working with trauma. And you might be listening and thinking, well, I don't work with trauma. I'm a policy advisor working on economic development or whatever your job title is. But Louise explains that trauma is always with us. She calls it the ghosts in the room. They're always there, they're always around us, and there are those shocking moments where they show up. And when we learn to embrace those shocking moments where trauma is showing up, then we can shift ourselves away from being a high-performing team that might have a great output, but not necessarily a great impact, to a deep-performing team. One that is creating solutions from a deep connection with each other and with our planet. This is one episode that calls for you to check out the resources on our website. It'll be businesslab.co.nz/podcast/59 because Louise mentions a bundle of frameworks, ideas, people, resources, courses, programs, including a new social enterprise and book she's just launched called Reroot. So I think this could be a big jumping off point for a lot of you listening into some deep and important work. Now, just a heads up, Louise and I do talk about death in today's show. We share some different ways of thinking about death that might surprise you and might inspire you, but of course, you also might not be up for that today, so if that's you, then you may want to go choose another episode. That all sounds very serious, doesn't it? But don't worry, there's also a lot of lightness in this conversation too. So please welcome to the show, Louise Mara. I'm going to pass the rākau over to you. Ko wai koe, nor wai koe. Who are you, Louise, and which rivers do you flow from?
Kia ora, Paul. Kei te kai karakia, beautiful. And ko wai o ngā toi rawa pōti. Sorry. I am a bit nervous. Ngā toi rawa ko pōti ki te whenua, ngā tūho te rangatiratanga. Ko Louise Mara tuku ingoa. Tēnā koe. Tēnā koe to you. Beautiful to be here. So I whakapapa to Ngāi Tūhoe and also Ngāti Pākehā. So also have Irish, Scottish, French, Italian, English. And it's very kind of relevant to my work in a way. So I feel myself as a braided river called Waimana Te Awa. So Waimana is my river where I come from. I grew up in Te Uruwera, Whakapapa, Te Tūhoe, but all these other ancestral rivers that I belong to. And I felt myself being both colonizer and colonized many times through these ancestral rivers. So much of my work has been how to bring these together within me and how do we kind of bring these together outside. So that journey's led me on quite a rich journey of systems and self as systems, and how do we heal these big rifts in our systems that keep giving us the same outcomes. So yeah, I've been my own work in progress.
And when we will be until the day we die and beyond. Thank you, Louise. I love what a unique way of introducing yourself there, as acknowledging the past that you bring with you from those braided rivers from Ngāi Tūhoe and Ngāi Pākehā. I'm really interested, can you take me back to some of your upbringing, Louise? And, you know, you sound like you're really self-aware right now of who you are and where you're from and what's going on inside you. But where did that journey start for you?
Yeah, it's so funny as you ask that question. I have such a memory just flash into me of sitting on a hill. We had a farm on the edge of the Uruwera National Park. And I used to sit on this hill as a very young girl thinking, what is a human? That was my question.
Wow.
From very young, like, what does it mean to be human? Like, what is a human life? And so I feel like that's been my question I've been following for most of my life. But quite a rich upbringing there. And one of the things I've really been grateful for is we went to a very small school, Waimana school, and you know, we often couldn't get enough teachers there. And so we all had a garden. We were all outside a lot of the time. So my schooling was so different, which I've always valued as I went into the mainstream world. I felt like the initial patterning through my being and brain wasn't funneled through such mainstream learning. And also being in the Uruweras, it's such a magical place that has its own wairua. So growing up close to nature, trees were my best friends, fellas, people. So, yeah, I had quite a special upbringing.
I mean, I'm going to assume that it's probably not every child sits around going, what is a human? Why am I here? What's the purpose of life? And in fact, most adults have run away from that question as well. So what is it, do you think, that made you lean into that?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful question. Hey, I kind of feel we are born to learn and we're born on a sort of trajectory in a way. So that just was what was in me. And it's not really a question most of my family would ask either.
Right.
Also see families as systems, and each family in a way also has kind of evolutionaries whose purpose is to help the family system evolve. That sounds a bit grandiose, but I don't feel like that because it's actually very painful. Because you don't always fully belong in your own family system.
Yeah.
And it really has been such a strong thread for me of what does it mean to be human and why is the world the way it is and how to change that. So I've had a life of change making, really.
Yeah. It's interesting for me to hear you say that, because I wouldn't go so far as to say I'm the change maker in my family system, but I'm certainly more one of the ones who would sit around and navel gaze, or you got your head in your cloud, the clouds, Paul, or the differences between me and my wife. Every morning when I have a shower, one of the thoughts that's in my head is today could be my last day. I could die today. I could get hit by a bus, or I could have a heart attack, or whatever. Okay, and I find that the most empowering, enlivening thought, because it says, well, I have to be alive today and actually take notice of it. It's just interesting hearing you talk about playing that role in your family system. But of course, families are so complex and confusing, and they're always changing with new people. So what does that role actually look like for you when you're really fully in it?
I first want to comment on what you said about death. Because I love
Yes.
that you brought that in.
Just
It's,
dropping that in. There we go.
yeah,
Yeah. Now we're talking.
I can't jump over that, honestly.
Yeah.
It's been such an advisor to me as well. So I love hearing someone else say that that's the role death plays for you. And I actually did a TED talk on it around death as a prime advisor to life.
Okay.
Because I really have the same thing, and I had so much death and loss in my life that really working with death has helped fuel my life in the same way I can hear it does yours. And yeah, it's a beautiful advisor because to me, if something doesn't withstand the kind of the test of death, then it's not that real. Like that keeps it real as well. So anyway, I really love that.
And I've never heard of that death as an advisor, but now I've just got this image of, I don't know, future me or something on my shoulder saying, does this really matter? And actually, that can be a guide for us when we're in those situations and we get stressed of, oh, this work is going on and it's so important and we have to get this meeting or this document or, things that can seem so important in the moment, but actually, when you zoom out a bit, they're just small.
But it's also like live you this day. Oh, like live you this day. Humans have a way of switching themselves off and becoming very mechanistic and rote. There's not much magic in that. There's not much magic locked up in those habits. Well, actually, there is magic locked up in those habits, but it's not being released. So, yeah.
What do you mean there is magic in those habits?
Well, I guess it kind of points to the way I work in a way is how do we really bring human potential? Like I'm so interested in full human potential to look at the way we make solutions for our world, like the way we change make. So much of how I feel is that the way we change make needs the most looking at if we want to make change. We have to really look at that. And I've kind of trained in the human nervous system, but also in the collective nervous system around collective trauma, intergenerational trauma, and its role in keeping systems stuck. So the way our individual nervous system works is very similar to the way the collective nervous system works. So we may, as individuals, numb out to a whole parts of our life that we're not ready or resourced or supported to be able to face, but it's the same in the collective. But this numbing to the nature of the problem and over-mentalizing, and I can't feel my way through this or sense my way, locks up a lot of that potential.
Can we jump back a step there, Louise? Because you talked about we need to change the way we do change work. And I hear you. So many organizations, their normal way of being is thought-based, it's very analytical, logical. That's kind of given weight in how people show up and how they do things, and emotions and feelings are put to the side. They're seen as somehow less important or valid or valuable in a work context generally. And you've worked in government, so in MB and DPMC. And others, how would you describe that kind of normal way of doing change in those sorts of contexts?
Yeah, these are all such big questions. I'm kind of going to come at that in a certain way, hey, because you're really honoring of all the people working in these systems. There's a lot of people I met who were trying to system differently, and yet structures and processes made that pretty hard for them to be able to do that. So I do feel very honoring. One of the things, one of kind of the waking ups I had in a way is how much trauma is in every room. We often call them the ghosts in the room. So what you get, say, in policy teams, senior teams, so many teams, is people are in their trauma adaptation. So if you like, fight, flight, fear, threat, competition, scarcity, all these things play out in teams and in processes, which means in some ways that our solutions are born out of those trauma highways. It's quite a lot to get your head around, but once you see it, it's very profound. So they're not coming from connection, they're coming from really a disconnect. Having spent, say, 30 years in the public service, there are also systemic issues in the public service, like there's not enough valuing of what each person brings. So they're immediately often trying to overprove, or they're a bit frozen, or they're frightened because you've got all these ministerial hierarchy. And then the way we gather evidence has a mindset to it, and a shallowness, I often think, when the way we have evidence. So our solutions come from disconnected places. And then we know, hey, like I ran, I was in charge of a cross-government office, the Auckland Policy Office. So I worked across agencies. It was an unusual role, but so much competition between agencies. So much, let's just look like we're playing, but so much territorialism. These are all kind of traumas. I know it's a big word, but I really use it intentionally because these things can be changed. But our solutions are all disconnected solutions.
I hear and understand what you're saying there, and I've got lots of questions. Well, one of them is, what's different about individual trauma versus collective trauma, apart from obviously just the number of kind of people involved? I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, in some ways, the linkages between collective, intergenerational, and individual trauma are very close. They're all close.
So we probably don't even need to distinguish.
Yeah, distinguishing is really helpful because some represents, like, say, your specific attachment wounds that then you play out in groups. So our family system, I talked before about the family being a system. How you were in your family system is generally how you will play yourself out in a senior leadership team. So again, then a senior leadership team that's guiding these huge ships of wisdom are actually guided by people who are still playing out their trauma patterns, which is why I say trauma leads the solutions. And we haven't yet got enough, I don't think, depth into some of these teams that can know how to come back to optimal human connectedness so that we can form these really connected vessels that the solutions in some ways emerge out of. I'm very into emergent strategy, prototyping. There's a whole different way rather than the way we've kind of been locked into. And I know many are experimenting with these things as well. If I go into a collective team and say I often work with teams where there's Māori, Pacific, Pākehā, there's so much in that room that if you keep ignoring that, it's always a slightly weird or off what solution come up with. So the work I do is let's not ignore it. Let's kind of transform the past as we make solutions together. And it's very vital now because a lot of the collective traumas, like I've been done some work in Black Lives Matter in the US and climate trauma, colonization, they're all here. And people are kind of like reeling, well, what do we do with them? But we actually have to start working at more multiple levels than just the mentalization level.
But before we get into that, people listening might be going, Louise, I've got my project and it's 9 months and we've got to deliver the thing. And I'm worried that if we open up this space for us to look at our trauma, that's all we're going to do for 9 months. So how do we balance out that need for got to get stuff done with embracing the need for connection between all the people who are working on something?
The way that I approach this, because I totally understand that, and you also don't want to spend years just looking at the trauma.
Yeah.
That's not how life works. But I've been working with the collective impact people overseas, and we've been looking at how collective trauma presents itself within organizations. And it's quite, if you look at it, then you go, oh my God, that's how our system is. Like, it's quite astounding.
Right.
I've kind of designed my own systems models based off all the work I've done, which kind of looks at how do we create, I call them deep performing teams.
Okay.
That actually, oh, it's including the trauma as it arises. So say colonization in the room, that's recognized that it's in the room as it arises. So my systems model kind of looks at the symptoms and how we actually gather evidence, but then it looks at the structures and what we need to look at, what needs to come apart. Because we think structures, and by structures I mean institutional policies, law, the whole way we set up society. So what might be ready to come apart and do differently? And then paradigms. Well, whose worldview are we in? So in this paradigm layer, you're working with it. And then there's the trauma layer, so that it's always trying to arise to be restored. Once you understand the nature of trauma, you can stop being so frightened of it, because it's trying to arise to be restored.
Sorry, what does that mean? Yeah.
Well, say you're in a leadership team and there's a clash of paradigms.
Okay.
Methods that I've designed, you stop. And you allow people to actually just presence their felt sense of how this conversation's affecting them. Because you can't just talk about these things without it being felt. So it's just including these very human natural layers of how, who's mostly affected by this conversation and how does it affect you? And once that can be included, then it doesn't become like the ghost in the room. It's included. And then the last part of my systems model, and I can show you as well, but is around Modi order. The only place we should recreate is when we come back into this flow of life, come back into the life force, and we create together. So you're either in kind of Modi order, this flow of life, or this fear and disconnect. My work's about we can't keep creating change from fear and disconnect. We're in a connection crisis with the planet, with each other. But the connection means that we have to include more human to human whole faculty meeting. So I just say there's so many meetings and no one meets. Stop.
Yeah, and that resonates with me, Louise, when I think back to the most impactful moments I've had as a facilitator. It's been when I've simply said something like, I'm noticing that, and you notice what's happening in the room, you know, what are other people feeling or sensing about what's going on? And in other words, you start to have a conversation about your conversation. You're almost sort of standing on the balcony above, looking at it. Oh, well, we were talking about this, and that made me feel that, and it made me. And those are often the most powerful moments, more than the preset structured moments, which often when we're in this kind of work, we want to get the agenda set beforehand and have a degree of certainty about what's going to happen. But it's those spontaneous moments that the group can come more alive.
Yeah, I love that you can see that. And that's so right, what you said. The group comes more alive. If you step back from, we're also content driven.
Yeah, yeah.
And issue driven.
Yeah.
To what's happening in the relational field. And if you can include all of what's happening in the relational field, something comes more alive.
Mm.
That's very true. And what I say is that aliveness is what leads the solutions.
Mm.
But for most teams, they stay fragmented and then they think that's going to birth something that's not fragmented.
Mm.
To me, that's slightly crazy. So it's not that you stop and look at trauma for 9 minutes, it's that you include the felt responses as we work through.
Okay.
What it does is form deep relational fields. And one of the things I'm so grateful for is in my collective intergenerational trauma training, which was in Israel, we've had to do a lot of kind of we space work together.
Mm.
So it's helped grow me up in some ways in this way of working. And it's opened the magic of what's possible if human fields truly come together.
Mm.
But there's a lot of people, teams not willing because, and I think it's just they're frightened.
The question that's coming up for me here is, where do we start? Because I'm hearing from you, we don't go, okay, everyone, so now we're going to look at our individual and collective trauma. But what is that starting point so we can make it more normal?
I just want to come back to one thing and then I'll answer that you said. Because you say a lot that I really...
Yeah. I'll just shut up and ask questions rather than having my own reflections from now on. Okay.
I also think what's happening in, say, senior levels of organisations is they're realising actually they don't have the capacities they need for a whole different approach. And that's fearful too.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the things I work with is a whole range of new capacities that we have to develop in order to be a system changing.
Mm.
So everyone wants to change the system, but people don't want to be the system changing.
Yeah.
My work with teams is how do you be the system changing?
Mm.
And this is a huge thing to say, and I won't go into it, but most organisations sit on trauma fields. So if you imagine Oranga Tamariki sits on a trauma field, that trauma field's always going to be trying to come through senior people to be restored. But if they don't work with it, hey, it'll distort things.
Mm.
We end up with a lot of distortion in our systems. But these capacities, like just to give you some examples of what I work with people, are like being disorientated.
Okay.
You actually have to learn to be lost, but to be disorientated. Otherwise, you'll stay with your wiring.
Mm.
Being undoers, you know, being wrong, being these paradigm switches, being with. Like being able to be with, being embodied, like ground, you know, all of these things is a whole range. But so I think what I saw is such a lot of self-protective, defensive responses sitting within teams that can't unleash these capacities magic for really true systemic change. But anyway, I've lost your question.
Well, my question was,
how do we do
where do we start? Yeah. And I guess what's coming up for me is is I'm hearing there's both this individual work of being the system changer, not just doing systems change work to others. And I'm hearing there's this collective work, and I'm presuming they go hand in hand. It's an and, not an either or. But yeah, I'm just thinking of the people who listen to this show, and they're sitting in the middle of a hierarchy, and they might be listening going, I hear what Louise is saying, and I can see this trauma around me that's not being addressed, but I have no idea how to go about creating some space for that.
I've kind of put together a whole body of work around this. Foundation North and the Centre for Social Impact have actually funded me and others, and we've created a whole toolbox called Homanu, which is restorative leadership. And we're now taking 20 NGO leaders through to school them up to be able to take this approach. I think there is what I notice when I go into teams, you know, if I think about my system model of how do we include all the layers and roles needed, and I don't mean role as in you're this role, but I notice the abilities within a team are often there, but they're not allowed to use them because my role is a policy analyst. Actually, I know how to connect to Māori Order. I know how to connect to presence. I know how to give space and withness to when there's hurt in the room. So what I'm seeing is actually there's a lot there that if we allowed a much more collective intelligence approach, then a lot can come to life. So, you know, think, how do people actually start? So anyway, we've got these bodies of work really trying to get them out there. The collective impact people are starting to get, they're going to be publishing some work around this too. And then I guess there's a bit of an upskilling, but what I'm saying is there's a lot of skill embedded in organisations that hasn't been able to release.
There's skill, but maybe not an awareness of how that skill could be put to use or when it might be put to use.
And there's a lot of Māori and Pacific people that have these skills.
Yeah.
So as we start to decolonize and not be based on white superiority, these actually could play such a big part in the restoration.
Yeah.
And then I think for people to start, it's also looking at the way you system, like we all create the system. We all, I use system as a verb. We all world, we all system.
Okay.
And it's very beautiful to start to look at that for yourself. And then I like creating kind of pockets of light or consciousness within organisations that can actually start to work in this way. There's some that you will never change out of the way they work. But I don't think we're as weak as our weakest link. I don't buy that. I think a group of people who start to work in this way have a huge impact.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was the director of the Leadership New Zealand program for about 12 years and working with a lot of leaders on being the change. And I think leaders are healers. Leaders need to work in the healer archetype. What else are they doing if they're not restoring connection with each other, with the planet, across these divides? Like, what else? I often say to leaders, well, what are you doing? If you're not helping this deeper connection crisis to birth new solutions, then you're really just propping up something we know doesn't work.
So that's a hard truth for people to hear.
Yeah.
yes, it is.
But there's hard truths we have to look at. Our planetary crisis is one, hey? And how do we do it together? In these collective traumas, you can't do it alone. It's got to be two people.
Safety and ethics comes up for me here, Louise. How do we have the kind of conversations we need to have? How do we name things that are The ghosts. What did you call them? The trauma ghosts in the room. How do we do that safely and ethically?
One of the capacities I work with people in this work is how do they be a sanctuary and how do they create sanctuaries? Because we need, people need to be, feel safe in order to bring their full potential. I just think in some ways in this course I'm running, I say this work is totally in some ways radical and in some ways 100% natural. People have always sat around campfires, restoring, presencing, saying how they feel. And it's, I think it's a weird thing that we now consider that unsafe. And I often say to people, yeah, but being safe doesn't mean you're not going to have to feel. It's almost safety has got a very loaded onto it now. I think we have to look at that because it's also can be a attack. People are like, often you can use it as an attack, and they can also use it as a,
What do you mean by that?
well, I don't feel safe, so that's
Right.
a problem. There's so much unsafety inside most people. There's so much unsafety in organizations now.
And there's probably a difference between unsafe and uncomfortable.
Yeah, unsafe and uncomfortable. And organizations have been so unsafe for Māori and Pacific people and really cared about that. So I work with safety as what does everyone see as safety and what do people need for safety? And how do we create sanctuary together, which again is about can I stay in connection when things get uncomfortable? So, you know, this whole thing of rupture and repair, the highest form of relationship trust is when they do rupture, but I know you're not going to go away. You're going to stay in to repair. Well, that's the same with teams is, you know, so lots of the processes I run are clearing processes of all the elephants that haven't been cleared that become a senior leadership team gets stuck. But, you know, how do we work with this layer of discomfort? I think that's what we need to tool up with and create enough sanctuary to do it, but not collude that safety means I don't have to do anything
So
differently.
it's not something that you can throw it up as a protection to say, well, I can't get involved in this. It's a free pass. I hear that. And I also hear the worldview that might be underneath my question as well. And when you were talking about the gathering around the campfire, it also made me think about the extra dimension that comes in with working virtually. And you talk about connecting, reconnecting, and looking at the ghosts and trauma ghosts in the room. How does that play out in a virtual environment, do you think?
I do a lot of global work virtually. I really believe we can create connective tissue through the screens. I know that we can do that. And I think we have to keep finding ways of doing that. And remember, it's not like we go, okay, now let's all look at the trauma. It's like when it's there and there's felt senses of issues that it's included. And like you said, there's people who know how to go to the balcony. That's what William Urie says, hey, I can go to the balcony. We can go, whoa, what's just happening here? Our whole group's just gone into a freeze. You know, you can feel it in a room. You've
And
jumped
actually, I.
all over it. We all know how to work with those to bring us back into life force and creativity.
I'm wondering if it might be helpful for people to hear like a real life example of that and to hear what your advice or guidance might be. The real life example being a while back, I was running a 2-day training workshop on youth engagement. And I think it was the second day in the morning. No, it was the first day in the morning. We were looking at a model of youth development called Mana Taiohi. And based on the idea that all young people are born with mana, with this inside them. And so when we're working with young people, there are things that we can do to help them to see their own strengths and understand how everybody and everything around them can uplift that. And anyway, so there's quite a lot of te reo Māori in this mana taiohi model. And the most senior leader in the room, sort of towards the end of the activity, grumpily says, "I don't see why we're doing this activity. We don't work that much with Māori, so I don't really see why we've been doing this." And then the next most senior leader in the room says, "Yeah, I don't get it. I don't understand these words. And I think this activity has been a bit of a waste of time." And you can feel the tension in the room. Suddenly everyone's like, "Whoa, okay, what's happening? Here we go." How do we respond in that moment?
Yeah. You know, so many things are context specific, eh? Yeah. But if I'd say been working with a group for a while, I would totally stop then, do your go to the balcony and go, yeah, "Whoa, it's like a shock's come into the room. Mm. Let's all presence how that makes us feel. What's going through people?" So people go into a freeze, say, you can feel, and they're a bit contracted, or they're gone into fight flight. I mean, I think the nervous system work is astounding for what it how it helps us deal with all of this. So first thing is, okay, let's just pause, hey, because that feels like a shock's come into the room. And let people just digest it and presence how they feel. "Oh yeah, I feel a bit frightened now. I feel a bit, yeah, I feel like I've withdrawn. I feel angry, like it's just taken something away. I feel," including the people who bought the shock, "how does it feel now to hear how this has landed?" And there's no shaming, hey? Okay, there's something arising out of the collective spirit, the collective intelligence, that's trying to resist or block, hey? Let's just go, okay, that's what's in the collective. There's so much resistance and blocking. How might we work with this differently? Because I 100% totoku what you said, that everyone is born with mana. Everyone is born, in nervous system language, we'd say ventral vagal, this connected, amazing, beautiful place that's their creative spark. So, you know, resistance is also intelligence. What sits behind it is fear. It depends on the capacity of those two people. But actually helping them see the impact of that can have a lot of change. And then what you do as the facilitator, or what a team goes, is, wow, we can trust that something different can happen when these come in. Because this work isn't about trying to not make them come in. But I often also name, let's work with resistance. Let's work with fear. So it doesn't drive us or the agenda. And then this work with the collective impact people of really including the capacity to work with these trauma states as they arise, fight, flight, freeze, fear, survival energy, in order to come out of them to create the world. And I think we can all become literate on that.
Thank you, Louise. Lots to digest in all of this conversation. And I'm just really hearing from you this overall message of leaning into this with curiosity and open-mindedness and non-judgment, which in itself is a whole lot of work to be able to do that in those tense moments. And you talked about understanding your nervous system, and I have to give a shout out here to one of your teammates, Tui Williams, who, well, she's been coach helping me to understand what's going on in my brain and in my body when I'm in those tense moments.
Yeah.
And what do I need? Exactly. And how do I become aware of what's coming up in me so that then I can respond from a more sort of equal place and be okay with whatever's coming up in me? And that's been really helpful to actually do that work on and with myself.
Yeah, that's so beautiful and that's so true. So many people are still saying what's happening to them, not what's happening in them, as part of presencing what's needed in the collective. So, I mean, one of the things I haven't said, but this work needs resourcing and resourcing. So, some of the things I've created, I've just created a new social enterprise and written a book called Reroute, which is a systemic book, but an individual equipping. Actually, I believe everyone who can and has any inclination to weave themselves back into the flow of life, out of these distorted, trauma-orientated, separated places. So the book's a very systemic and practical book about how do you do that. And that's what everyone can do, is actually start to support themselves and reconnect themselves. So that's what kind of that work is about. And helping people be able to kind of navigate their own waters as well as the waters within a team. And that is humans' work at the moment.
And there's a lot of agency and hope in that, I find, because when I started working with Tui, I came in with a lot of blame. If only somebody else would do something different, then everything would be so much less stressful for me and my work. And I was completely unaware of how much I was putting the obligation onto others. That was a shocking moment for me when I saw that and went, oh, wow, I have to start this. And the only responsibility that matters for me is my own responsibility in this. So, yeah, fantastic. Reroute. There's a website, there's a book, there's even a short online self-guided course.
There is, yeah, there
Awesome.
is.
So there's a place that people listening can start, actually, is what's the work within me?
Yeah, and there's a lot of resources in there to help. And I really honor that you've done that work, Paul.
I haven't done it. It's still going.
I mean, I can feel it. You can feel that, eh? And I kind of see responsibility as our ability to respond. But that's a different thing than an ability to react. That's a really empowering place, isn't it? Oh, wow, I can respond.
I've never thought of it like that. Respond ability,
Yeah.
responsibility.
And yeah, such a beautiful journey. And we need compassion for this work because of where we are and the trajectories. Humans hold magic. My sitting on the hill, what's a human? Traversed a whole lot to come back to humans have such a beautiful magic and way they can operate together. And to me, one of the only things that distorts all of that is the trauma and centuries of undigested, unrestored trauma, which fragments us. So, yeah.
Thank you for reminding us of where we began this conversation, Louise. Is there anything final that you'd like to add for people listening?
The other things of the other journey I've started this year is a movement called the Pakeha Project. And if anyone's interested in that, and it's got a lot of government people on it this year, but it's really around Pakeha taking their place and leading a new world. And it also takes this approach, but very much looks at paradigms, white human superiority, but really tools people. You know, Pakeha leaders up for this work. So it's another place if people are interested, they can get hold of me on there. The name's quite
Awesome.
controversial, but I kind of loved it that Pakeha are always creating projects, so I created a project about them. Anyway.
Nice. Louise, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. This has been not an eye-opening conversation, but more like a heart-opening or a spirit-opening conversation. And yeah, I feel like this is, for people listening, could be a spark for the start of some new work for them. So I'm really grateful to you.
Thanks, Paul. Really enjoyed being with you and the way you approach all of this. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Beyond Consultation podcast. What did you learn from the show? What should we have talked about? Who else should I interview? I would love to hear your feedback. And if you want to learn more about what you heard today, everything from the show is at www.businesslab.co.nz/podcast. If this episode has left you with a burning question, please feel free to submit a voice message through the link on our podcast page. We can then ask that question of a guest in a future episode. Or tag me in a post on LinkedIn or Facebook and I can point you in the right direction. If you want to know when we release new episodes, make it easier for yourself and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Again, thank you for listening. Ngā mihi mō te whakarongo.